Well, I'm very happy to be back at St. Matthew's this morning. For those of you who don't know who I am, my name is Reed Carlson, and I was the Young Adult Ministries Director here up until just a few months ago when I moved to Germany. And so I've been in Europe for the last few months, but it's been wonderful to be back home for Christmas and to be with my friends and family. A few weeks ago, some of my German friends took me to a soccer game. Because I'm such a huge sports fan. This was not my first soccer game in Europe. To be honest, I can't really get into what's going on down on the pitch. However, I love going to these games because of what I've come to call the second game. And so if you've never been to a soccer game in Europe, or if you're not familiar with that kind of world, let me just explain to you a very important dynamic that's different than going to spectator sports here. At any given time, there are at least two games being played. There's the first game, which happens kind of down on the field, and it involves like a ball and goals and highly paid people from South America and that kind of stuff. And then there's a second game, which to me is much more exciting, and this one occurs in the stands, and it's one team's fans versus another team's fans. And the goal is who can cheer better. And you can use songs, you can use chants, flags, drums, horns, screaming children, fireworks, whatever you happen to have at your disposal. And basically, for the entire time you're at one of these games, somebody somewhere will be singing something. And the lyrics to these songs are sometimes complicated and clever, but more often they're just really cryptic and kind of confusing. I think back at home, we say stuff like, 1, 2, 3, go, or something like that. But over there, it's like references to 19th century European history, or like criticism of the particular accent of the region where the team comes from. I was at a game in England where these three drunk guys just kept chanting chicken tikka masala over and over again. That's a curry dish. I don't even know who they were cheering for, but literally just chicken tikka masala. That was the entire thing. What I love about these chants is that for an outsider, they're complete nonsense. They make absolutely no connections for me. But I think for an insider, each little chant is full of little hooks that connect it to the history of a region or of a team or of a people group or something. You see, most of human language, and especially human storytelling, is full of these little hooks. Our language is almost always more than the words we say. So, for example, if I begin a story once upon a time, a native English speaker is going to know the kind of story that's going to follow. So this morning, when I read from John's Gospel, and it begins with, "In the beginning," a clued-in Jewish Christian from the first or second century is probably going to know what he's referring to, where that hook is leading him. And probably many of you do this morning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? That's a hook all the way back to the beginning of the Bible, Genesis 1. This hook is maybe pretty obvious. And if you've been attending church for a while and you hear this text being read around Christmas, you've probably heard that connection before. This morning, I want to tell you about another hook in this passage, which I bet you've probably never heard before. You see, around the time that the New Testament was being written and collected, a new form of literature was appearing in Jewish circles. This was a time when the world was changing, especially for Jews, both in and outside of Judea, of modern-day Israel. The language of the Bible, of the Old Testament, Hebrew, this was no longer widely spoken by very many people. That's why the New Testament is written in Greek, not in Hebrew, because that was the common language at the time. However, the language of Judaism at this time, the language that would have been Jesus' first language and the disciples' first language, was actually Aramaic, not Hebrew. So the rabbis devised a system of teaching so that they could still teach the Hebrew Bible to an Aramaic-speaking audience. And they called these teachings targums, which is a word that just means translation, targum. So at their most basic level, the targums were just translations of the Old Testament from Hebrew into Aramaic. But the rabbis didn't simply copy the Bible from one language to the next. That's impossible, because all translation is interpretation. Instead, they decided to use this act of translation as an opportunity for teaching. So when they would translate, they would actually alter a phrase here, or elaborate a little there, or take away a little bit. They would ask questions, or clarify something, or propose answers. Now, this process might seem kind of difficult for us to envision today, but folks just had a different attitude towards biblical texts back then. There was more elasticity as it was transferred between languages. Now, I bring these targums up because when you read a targum, as I'm sure many of you have, when you read a targum, especially the translations of Genesis, and that's where John's hooks are bringing us, you find incredible connections to John's gospel, to the gospel we read this morning. Throughout Genesis, the rabbis added an Aramaic word to help clarify the text. It's everywhere. It's all over the place. And the word is memra. So, for example, when Adam and Eve are in the Garden of Eden, according to a targum, they don't hear God walking in the garden. They hear God's memra walking in the garden. During the flood narrative, God's memra is what actually feels pain and regret over the fate of humanity. God's memra is active in the creation of man and woman during Genesis 1. And later, God's memra is the agent that returns Israel from exile. God's memra is all over the place, doing all sorts of things. Memra also has a verbal form, which just means to speak. So when God says, "Be fruitful and multiply," that's God's memra as well. So what is this memra? What is this thing that speaks and creates and feels and walks? Well, for John, the question wasn't, what is this memra? It was, who is this memra? Because the word memra in Aramaic just means word. At this time, John was joining a chorus of ancient Jewish interpreters who saw, for a variety of reasons, another agent of God working with God in creation. So when John came along, he was already plugged into these expectations, and he said, "That's Jesus, the divine word, the memra, that's Jesus Christ." So, why is this important? Why should it matter that John would make use of this ancient idea, this motif, from the beginning of the Bible? Well, this morning I want to suggest that John is successfully doing something with his religious tradition that many of us today are doing with our experiences and beliefs about God. You see, John had connected the faith of the past with the faith of his present and future. So let me try to give an example from my life. Many of you know that I did not grow up Episcopalian. I actually grew up in the Pentecostal tradition. And from the age of about 11 or 12, I felt called to the ministry. I wanted to become a minister. Specifically, I wanted to become a missionary. I wanted to go to Eastern Europe and work in formerly communist countries. These days, however, I'm an academic. I study the Old Testament, and I'm going to become an Episcopal priest. So there's quite a transition there from one to another. I don't have time this morning to go into great detail about my story. It's not a secret. I'd love to share it with you if you want to know. But to keep it short, that there came a point in my early 20s when I had to make a very difficult decision. I had already completed a lot of theological education, and I was basically just one step away from becoming a minister in the tradition that I'd grown up in. All I had to do was fill out the paperwork, basically. And amongst these forms was a faith statement where I had to agree to a number of beliefs. And I knew that I could not honestly check every single box on the list. And this was a very difficult decision for me. I had been preparing for this for most of my life. I still felt called to be a minister. I still wanted to go to Europe. I was graduating from college. I was thinking about jobs. I knew that I couldn't even apply for jobs unless I kind of was ordained or on the way to being ordained. And this was especially hard as well because I had not really had a bad experience in this church growing up. The people who had brought me up in faith, who loved me, who taught me, had been truly faithful, wonderful people. God had always been very present in my life. So when I didn't submit these forms, I had to fight this feeling that I was turning my back on God, on the God of the past and on those people who had loved me. I felt like I was saying that that God, those experiences, those lessons, they were no longer going to be a part of my life. And that really grieved me. Similarly, in the early church, there were some Christians who felt like the old religion, the old God, the old truths were completely gone now that Jesus had come along. But at the same time, there were others who had experienced the presence and power of Jesus Christ, but who could not accept that grace because they feared they would be turning their backs on where they had come from. In the midst of these tensions comes John's words, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and lived among us." In other words, the God we knew then is still our God now. That hasn't changed, and yet everything has changed. There are many of us here at St. Matthew's, many in the Episcopal Church, actually, who came from another tradition or came from another place. Maybe you grew up Catholic. Maybe you grew up evangelical. Perhaps you don't come from any Christian tradition at all. Maybe you did grow up Episcopal, but in a very different kind of setting. Even if you've gone to the same church your entire life, chances are you have gone through one or more transitions in your spiritual life. This is becoming increasingly true about our culture as we become more transient. Our spiritual lives are becoming increasingly characterized by dramatic transformations. So, for example, some of us grew up in the church, but maybe we've fallen into this trap of thinking that the God we knew as a child is not the God we know now as an adult. The God of the Bible, who is powerful, who you can pray to, who has influence in your life, that's all kind of the stuff we tell kids. Once you grow up, you have to face facts. The world is complicated, and God isn't really like that. That might be one example. Perhaps others of you here had a really negative experience in a church in your life. In fact, maybe it's a miracle that you've come back to any church at all whatsoever. Maybe you've been hurt by someone or by a group of people or by a certain hateful attitude. And this hurt makes it difficult for you to recognize what was good before, where God was in your life before. It's become hard for you to recognize the places where God was present in your life in the past. And even today, it can be incredibly difficult to try to piece together who God is and what God has been doing in your life because you keep running into these pains and these reminders from your past. You see, transitions can often have these polarizing effects on us. We can either completely embrace them or deny the past. Or we can resist the transitions and instead have this kind of nostalgic view of the past while completely ignoring where God is present in our lives now. For me, this was the lesson I had to learn. And I've been in this process of learning it for many, many years. The God of my past is also the God of my present and future. This doesn't mean I have everything that I had everything completely right when I was young. It doesn't mean that I haven't matured or grown up a bit. But it does mean that God was there, perhaps in ways that I couldn't really appreciate until now. So let me just tell you honestly this morning, reconciling myself to that truth has been a source of healing and clarity and peace in my life. So I'm just closing with this thought. If you're struggling with navigating a spiritual transition, perhaps one from many, many years back, let John's words challenge you this morning. The relationship that we have with the Memra, the Word, Jesus Christ, is one that looks back as much as forward, helping us learn from our experiences, but also recognizing how God was present even then. Because what has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known. Amen.